Welcome to Camden Community Radio. This is Camden Unlocked for Radio 1812, International Migrants Day all over the world. 109 radio stations broadcasting in 37 countries. This is Camden Unlocked for Radio 1812, International Migrants Day. Music for today's programme has been supplied by Mark Brown. Mark Brown's tracks in today's programmes show influences from all kinds of places. The world we live in is a world of migrants. People go from here to everywhere and people come from everywhere to here. People have been coming to Camden for a very long time, and our culture is imbued with parts of culture from all over the world. I came to London, to Camden, in 1977. I came for the summer, and I stayed. And on the way, I met people from everywhere else in the world. That's what it's like. This is Marion Larrigy presenting Camden Unlocked for Radio 1812, International Migrants Day. We'll also be hearing from Ben Cooper. He's been talking with Jack Beula, who invented a record-breaking game and a whole lot of other things. He also goes on the trail of the Chilean wall mural. And we'll be going back to hear some of the people from the Summerstown Festival of Cultures that took place this summer. Keep listening. This is Camden Unlocked for Radio 1812, International Migrants Day. You are listening to Camden Community Radio, ccradio.org. But first, some more music from Mark Brown. This is Camden Unlocked for Radio 1812, International Migrants Day all over the world. 109 radio stations broadcasting in 37 countries. This is Camden Unlocked for Radio 1812, International Migrants Day. I talked with talent show organiser and cheerleader promoter Valerie Amajute, as she reflects on a range of migrant experiences.
We are the Kelthorpe All-Stars. We're holding auditions for Just Dance. Kelthorpe All-Stars and the Mighty Maidens. We're a cheerleading and pom dance group. We're currently putting on an event for talent, and it doesn't really matter what level you're at. It's for beginners, intermediate, and advanced. And the event we're doing this time is called Jingle Bell Rocks, but the whole event is called Just Dance, so it's the second event of three. It is going to be on the 18th of December at the Kelthorpe Project, from the ages of 8 to 21. We're based in the Maiden Lane, Kelthorpe Project, and the Pageant Christian Church. Pageant Christian Church is in the border of York Way, so it's on the Islington side. So it doesn't really matter where you come from, as long as you want to show your talent, just to see what's around London, what talent children have. It's giving the opportunity for any level to show their talent. So beginners can do it, and they're judged on that level of beginners and intermediate, because sometimes people are shying away from these events because they think you have to be so talented or have the best costume. And it's more about everyone has a bit of talent in them, so just letting them express it. They're always volunteer judges. This first event we did was called Midnight Mayhem. And it was just around the Halloween time. And we had someone from the Maiden Lane Community Center judge. And then we had two judges from Biz and Fizz. It's another organization, youth project in Highgate, Newington. And we invited them along to be judges because we have to be impartial. You know, we know the youth, so we like to bring outsiders.
What were they like? Were they good?
They were really good. We had actually two people that were special needs, and one of them won. And a group of three girls that did a Bollywood kind of dance, they won. A little girl who did some African kind of dance, and she won. And a little boy who did Michael Jackson, and he won. And then the last one we'll have is on the 30th of April, and it'll be at Jackson's Lane in Islington. And there'll be a one final big trophy to win, plus the four trophies for the entries.
Let's hear another one of Mark Brown's tracks. Hi, Valerie. You're involved in Calthorpe All-Stars cheerleaders. And we associate cheerleading with America. You're an American?
Yes, I am. I was born in America and California.
You were born in America and California. Are you an American-American for generations or...?
No, my background is Mexican-American, so Latin. And although all my family was born in America, my background, my ancestry would be Mexican-American and Spanish.
And so are you aware of that in your cultural sort of practices?
I mean, we were brought up in predominantly, I would say, white area. And so our culture wasn't really brought into it. I think it was more my sense of importance of knowing the Spanish language and knowing a bit more about my culture. I think I found that more important to me than growing up, because I know a lot of Latin families, they bring that up with their children. They learn Spanish at home, where I didn't. And I learned it in school. So I don't think being an American born there, especially your parents, if they're not brought up in that same way, it's not passed down from generation to generation. Even my children, they don't know Spanish, and sometimes they get upset with me thinking, why don't you speak to me in Spanish? But it's not my first language, so I'm more comfortable speaking English. And to speak to someone in Spanish, it's a lot of energy, because you need to think English and Spanish and, you know, about the language. So I tend to only do it when people don't speak English or speak Spanish.
So is that an issue for a lot of migrants?
I think you lose your ethnicity as if your parents don't instill that in you as you're growing up. To blame anyone. It's just that culture maybe not allow for that, or maybe their parents didn't speak to them in that language. So you're tending to lose bits. So, I mean, I have my children learning Spanish in school as well, like I did. And I'll help them in that way. And I put them in Latin American dancing so they know a bit more about the culture. So I think it really is the parents. If you are from different ethnicities, it's best that the parents bring that into your life, because, you know, at some point you're going to wonder about your culture. So
then you've become a migrant yourself by moving from the US of A to the UK?
Yes, I've been here for about 21 years now. And I came originally as a student, and then I met my children's father, and he's from Morocco. And we went back to America for a couple years, but he didn't want to lose his residency here. So we came back, and I had my first two children in America and my last two children in England. So there's a bit of a mixture of cultures.
And so you're promoting something that we associate with mainstream American culture, cheerleading. What attracted you to that?
Well, originally, it was that there was a lot of stuff for boys to do that was quite physically active. And girls could join in, like, football and, you know, all those sports, but it didn't really let them show their femininity. Cheerleading, there's two kinds of cheerleading. There's pom dance and stunting. And the stunting seems to be the attraction for, I'd say, the older set of kids. And that's where you have to have tumbling skills, dance, cheer, and acrobatic skills as well.
So that's where you throw people up in the air.
Yes, that's where you do all that. So I started with, my cousin came for 6 months and she wanted to do something while she was here. So we started a cheerleading group. It was actually through another contact I have where I'm on a committee, which is Algerian-British Connection. And she told me to promote something for girls. So I did it originally with her. And then after 6 months, I had all these girls that still wanted to continue. So I went and got my credentialing to teach them how to do the stunting, because it's quite intense, and you have safety aspects have to be adhered to. So that was one of my main priorities. But cheerleading, I mean, it's not only the physical aspects of it, it's the team building and the goal setting and the dedication that these kids are learning life skills. Mm-hmm. And through that, as well as they enjoy it, so they're having fun when they're doing it and they're learning. And also I promote, like, for them to get their credentialing to become a cheerleading coach themselves, so they can take something away with them as they get older and do it. It's such a growing sport. You'll be amazed that you think it's an American.
Yes, where did the tumbling come from? That's come from other parts of the world?
I'm not sure, actually. I mean, I think when cheerleading did start in America, but and it didn't really start with the tumbling and stunting. I think just people were trying to wow you more and taking it further. So, I mean, if you're a gymnast, I mean, we'd welcome you to come in, because tumbling is a growing aspect in England. When we first started, the tumbling wasn't so important, but now it's their skills have come on over the years. So everyone's trying to compete with that level.
So is the practice of cheerleading in England now different from the practice in America? Or how is it different?
In America, I'd have to say it's more organized, where it's one governing body for cheerleading. So you have to pass tests, and the safety aspects of it is more crucial. Here in England, they haven't really found their ground. You had people starting cheerleading here. I think it was about two main companies, and they kind of were saying that they were the governing body of cheerleading. But there actually is no governing body of cheerleading.
It's younger.
It's younger, and there's lots of people popping up their ideas of how they're going to structure it.
Are there cultural differences in what people want to do? You know, do people want to do different sorts of things here than would be typical in America?
Not cultural difference. I think that's pretty standardized what they want to do, but everybody wants to run the show, and it's not organized enough where they can all meet as one and say, this is what we're going to do. Yeah. and really think about the safety aspects of it. Because you're having people saying, okay, my daughter does cheerleading, I'm going to be a coach. Yeah. And if those children get hurt, you know, the responsibility lies with that person who's saying that she's going to be the coach. And if she doesn't have something behind her showing that she's learned those skills, then it's scary. It's scary to see that, you know, anyone thinking, okay, I'm going to be a cheerleading coach, you know.
So we're not nearly ready for a World Council of Cheerleading or an Olympic sport of cheerleading and tumbling, no?
There are some people that have structurized cheerleading, like there's the Ascension Eagles in the Docklands. They have it pretty well sussed out what you need. And there's a few organizations that come here that have been helped with American companies to show them, you know, what is needed. But for everyone joining as one, I think that's a little bit more difficult, because some people are old school and they have their ways and think this is the way it's going to be. And some people are bringing change that are going to potentially, because save lives, because it is a dangerous sport when you're hurling someone's child and she's flipping around in the air. You know, there's things that you need to cover, and that is scary. But it's a growing sport, and a lot of people are putting their hands in it, and I'm just hoping at some point it's going to get organized in a way that everyone's going to be on the same page.
So one more question for you. You're someone who was the child of a migrant, of migrants, and then you migrated yourself, and then you came to a country where you married a person who'd migrated from somewhere else.
Yes.
What would you say about the experience of being a migrant, or being from a migrant background, or having children who are the children of migrants now?
Actually, I've never really considered myself a migrant, even though I'm from a different culture. Separated myself from even other people that are from different cultures. I just see it as one big melting pot where, you know, different ideas come from different places. I think it is hard when you're with a different culture, though. I have to say that, because it's hard enough being in a relationship, and then dealing with another culture in the mix is even more difficult to understand. So you have to have a lot of patience and give and take. So I think my kids don't even realize as well the difference. Although it's funny to say that my children who were born in America say to all their, because they've gotten to do some schooling in America, they say to all their friends they're British. And my children who were born here, they tend to tell all their friends they're born in America. So it's, I guess, the grass is always greener on the other side, you know. my kids kind of show me as a showpiece because I do have an American accent. When their friends are like, oh, say something to them, I'm like, oh, what do you want me to say? You know, when I go back to America, my parents are like, this is my daughter, she's from England. I'm thinking, I was born here, why are you saying that? You know, so, you know, I think it's wonderful that I've had the opportunity to be in England and live here. And as well as I'm very proud to be American. But as I say now, my home is in England and I've been here for over 21 years. So I think the opportunities that I've had in this country have been really great. And the time that I've been allowed to spend with my children raising them, you know, I don't think I would trade that. Because in America, it's a different lifestyle. It's work, work, work. And, you know, you see what you have at the end of the day. But at the time, I think I would have missed out a lot of time with my children if I wasn't.
Do you mean as a parent, you wouldn't have time off work and those kind of
things?
Well,
in America, your values are different. You earn your living and you work really hard as a middle class person or, you know, whatever. But you have something to show for it. You have your house, you have, you know, your holidays with your kids, and it is family oriented. But here, I work part time and I do a lot of activities and voluntary work, but I still have that time with my children. And I find that very important because when I first came here, I had the mentality is I must work full time and, you know, bring in the money. And I missed out a lot on my older twos, bringing them up as babies, because I thought I had to find childcare and, you know, I was juggling so many things and I overwhelmed myself thinking I had to be it all. And I think that's the mentality you came with as in me being American, that I had to do everything. And here, as I got more involved with being British, I could see that I could try and balance my home life with my work life. Maybe, okay, I'm not richer, I'm probably poorer than that, but it's really what you find important and what your values are. And I think as my children are getting older, I'll have more time for myself, but I can honestly say that I've been there in the raising of my children. So.
And you mentioned that sometimes it's difficult when you're a migrant or when you're in a relationship with someone who's from another background, yet there must be benefits of it.
The benefits are your mind is widened to other cultures. And I mean, I've had teachers tell me about my children that they're, even when they've started nursery, that the knowledge that they have is so wide, and the conversations they could have as they're getting older was so wide. But that's because you let them know about everything. And I think me being of a different culture, I wanted them to do everything. Even, I mean, I remember when I first came here, there was an African dancing class and I had them do that. And people are like, well, why are you having them do that? They're not African. I said, well, they're North African because Morocco is in North Africa. And if that's another attachment for letting them know something else, it's better off for them. Even I had them doing Arabic classes. And I mean, their father didn't make that importance influence on them, but I think it's part of their culture. It's something they should be aware of. And it's down to them what choice. I mean, I'm raising them in my religion as a Catholic and he's a Muslim, but I wouldn't say that that's what they have to be the rest of their life. They will learn about the Muslim religion and they've had the opportunity to do that. And it's down to their choice what they will choose at the end. My older two aren't really practicing the Catholic religion or the Muslim religion, but they're aware and it's their choice of what they're going to choose at the end of the day.
So would you say anything to someone who's, you know, just wandered into the experience and is struggling? What advice would you give?
Wandering into experience of being with another culture? Or?
Yes, yeah. That they've kind of met people or someone and fallen in love or got involved or had a child and then they find that there's a whole lot more to take on than they quite realize.
Well, I think the first thing I would say is that people should be aware that being in a relationship is difficult as itself. So if you're going to even think about being with another culture, it's something that you really have to work out together from the beginning, because it's not something that you, I know that sometimes you say you fall in love, but really, if you want that to last, you need to really think about every part of it. I mean, when I fell in love, and I knew he was Muslim, I was looking in books and researching a little bit more about the religion and, you know, if that's something I could do, changed my religion. I thought about it and I thought, no, it's not something, but we had to have some kind of compromises. And I mean, I baptized my children and he came to the baptismal, so he made a compromise, you know, in accepting that. I think if he was more of a practicing in his religion, it would have probably been a bit more something that would cause chaos. But I think at some point we did give and take in certain areas, but it is hard work and you have to really think about it in any relationship, what's going to happen and, you know, how different you are and how you're going to make it work. So it does. I mean, I'm not going to say there's people that probably has worked, you know, and we still get along. But I think it's something you have to really think about hard in anything, is that the differences you have and can you make it work, because you'll be living in the same space, you know. So
this is Camden Unlocked for Radio 1812, International Migrants Day all over the world. 109 radio stations broadcasting in 37 countries. This is Camden Unlocked for Radio 1812, International Migrants Day. This is Camden Unlocked for Radio 1812, International Migrants Day all over the world. 109 radio stations broadcasting in 37 countries. This is Camden Unlocked for Radio 1812, International Migrants Day.
This is Queen Victoria's grandmother as a factual picture painted by Gainsborough. How would you describe her?
She looks of mixed race.
Right. This is Queen Victoria's grandmother, a woman who was of colour.
Jack Bueller. An amazing man. As a model, he was the face of Interflora. As a musician, he worked with top names such as Jazzy B. He was once even the agent for Hollywood legend Betty Davis. But that's not why he's amazing. He has probably done more than anyone else to highlight black history in Britain. His top-selling board game, Nubian Jack, spawned an organisation of the same name, educating young people, producing books, and putting up blue plaques celebrating important black and ethnic minority Britons. I joined him for coffee one morning and started by asking how the board game, the thing he is most famous for, came about.
Right, Ben, my background is social work. While working as a social worker, I began to work with lots of inner-city children, both black and white. And this was in the early 90s, and a lot of them had negative imagery of themselves, negative self imagery, negative media stereotypes. And I thought, well, why don't I try and redress that by making a game that will give them a sense of identity, a sense of positivity, and highlight the positive contributions made to Britain, particularly by black folk. And I called the concept Union Black. I couldn't get the name, Ben, Union Black, because there's a board game called Union from the 1950s, which still owned the trademark Union. So I thought, well, if I can't call it Union Black, I'll call it Nubian Jack.
It's been really popular, hasn't it? It outsold all the other board games in Hamleys or somewhere, didn't it, at one
point? Yes, and in the early days of its, when it was first launched, it did outsell Trivial Pursuit and Monopoly together, which created the phenomenon of, you know, or at least the beginning of the phenomenon, which is Nubian Jack. So unfortunately it hasn't continued to do such impressive sales, or I wouldn't be sitting with you, Ben. I'd be sitting with Time magazine reporter. But unfortunately I'm talking to you, which means its sales have slowed down slightly. But the thing is, it's mutated into a far more organic, far more dynamic, far more phenomenal concept, which of course includes books, board games, educational academy, and of course a heritage plaque scheme.
Bringing us on there to the heritage plaque scheme, how did this project come about? Because the blue plaques, we know English Heritage do loads of blue plaques. Mm-hmm. When did you decide that, hang on, there's not enough plaques celebrating black people? How did that project come about?
That's a good question. Actually, that wasn't my plan to redress that particular balance. I was happy doing Nubian Jack and the book. I was invited by English Heritage in 2004 to highlight, or at least bring more attention to, their BME plaque scheme, as they call it. Nubian Jack was asked to present a treasure trail which would get young people involved, schools participating. We did that with the launch of an eighth English Heritage BME plaque called the CLR James plaque in Brixton, no less, and that was a fabulous success. The following month after that launch, I said, why don't we do a plaque to Bob Marley? And it transpired that there was a lot of bureaucracy into producing plaques, and it wasn't as simple as highlighting, you know, someone as obvious as Bob Marley. And so the following year, I decided to do it myself, and it became the largest or most famous blue plaque in Britain. In fact, it became the subject of a BBC documentary.
And how do you go about getting a blue plaque put up on a building? You have to ask the permission of the owners of the building?
Or? You do. You have to, first of all, get a consensus that person requested, because you don't put up blue plaques. People request. I have a panel, and we get requests all the time, and we take it to the panel and we decide, is that person worthy, or they're all worthy, but is that person deemed more appropriate at this particular time? Once we've agreed that, then we apply to the owner of the building and we seek planning permission. In the case of like the plaque on the Foreign Office, for instance, we need to get consent not only from the Foreign Office but from English Heritage, who own listed buildings all around the country, I'm sure you know.
And that's quite a significant one, isn't it, the blue plaque on the Foreign Office? Tell us why there's a blue plaque there.
Actually, Ben, it's not a blue plaque, it's a stone plaque, because as a listed building, we could not put up a plaque which contravened the architectural structure of the existing infrastructure. So the plaque there is a stone plaque, and it's to a man called Ignatius Sancho, who was a phenomenal man, an absolutely amazing achiever in the 18th century. He was the only black man to vote in general elections. And the reason why he was able to do that was because he was a owner, property owner, a shop owner, and of course he was a free man as well. So, and if you understand the 18th century, there's a lot of white working class people who were in workhouses and very poor, and you know, having a pretty hard time, frankly. So for a brother to be able to enter the foray of local elections was some achievement. But to conclude, he was also an author, he was a composer, he was obviously a shop owner, and the man who helped to, or at least contributed to, the abolition of the slave trade in Britain.
The next blue plaque that's going up is to celebrate John Archer, who was the first black mayor in Britain.
That's correct. Well, he's the first black mayor in London. There was, for many a year, it was thought that he was Britain's first black mayor, but there's a man called Alan Mims, who's now been found to be a mayor in 1904 in Norfolk, of all places. John Archer became the mayor of Battersea in 1913, and he was an absolutely amazing man. He was a far more dynamic man, it would appear, than Alan Mims. At least a lot more is known about John Archer, and it's a total honour to be involved in honouring him with a blue plaque.
I was going to talk to you about your religious upbringing, because you had a religious upbringing, didn't you?
How did you know that, Ben?
I do my research.
Okay. I thought the man upstairs was talking to you. So. but he generally talks to me as well.
Are you still religious?
I'm a universalist. I believe in the universe. I don't believe there is a man upstairs pulling strings, because that would be sexist. But if I did believe a man upstairs was pulling strings, I think it was a black man. So let's put that straight. No, I believe there is a cosmic order, a karmic order, and I believe you give or sow what you, or reap what you sow. Equally, I think we have to go through cycles, and by cycles I mean astronomical cycles. I don't want to get too deep into this, Ben, but I believe that we are at the dawning of an awakening, where people are beginning to question the bullshit that they have been taught. Pardon my French, because I can speak a bit more eloquently, but bullshit is an appropriate word sometimes. You're not going to edit that bit, are you, Ben? Fantastic. And I think it's time that people do begin to question things, both religiously, both politically, both economically, both culturally, because if we don't, we will end up with more extremism.
Religion in the past, I think, suppressed people, I think, yes, and to make them think a certain way and keep people uneducated. Mm. But in the internet world, there's more opportunity for people to learn and discover the truth.
That's exactly it, Ben. The genie's out of the bottle. With this internet thing, if you ask a question, you can just ask the question, ask Jeeves, and Jeeves will come up with the answer instead of going to the index of some book in some library and spending an hour to find the facts. So, yes, all myths are being exploded. This is the age of awakening.
As you mentioned earlier, you've been a musician, a social worker, an entrepreneur, songwriter, model, all kind of things. What's the future for Jack Bueller?
It's, again, all to do with the karmic order. However long I have, I would like to make a contribution to humanity. And that's not a soundbite. That's what I like to do. And we're going to end by the question, why is Nubian Jack not better known? Because it's obviously on the radar of somebody. Why is it if I was to go out and shoot somebody tomorrow, I would be front page news? But the fact that I've had a board game that has outsold two of the most popular board games in history, a book that I went to America, I couldn't get a publishing deal over in the UK. Interesting question. I had to go to America, HarperCollins, and get a book deal with the largest publishers on the planet, HarperCollins. Why is it that this company has got plaques which are going up all over the country? I'm doing a plaque to Michael Jackson next year. That will change probably the concept of blue plaques and take it to another level. Why is Nubian Jack not better known, Ben?
A very good question. Now you all know about Nubian Jack as well. That was Ben Cooper talking with Jack Bueller. This is Camden Unlocked for Radio 1812, International Migrants Day. Ben Cooper goes on the trail of the disappearing mural. Here we are.
When local resident B. Thompson saw members of Transition Primrose Hill painting over an historic mural created by Chilean refugees in the 70s, she was too late to save it, but highlighted its importance and tracked down the man responsible for the original mural, Philip Hartigan. Philip, who now lives in France, spoke to Camden Community Radio on the phone. He told me how the project came about.
You go back to 1972, I did the bridge at Primrose Hill, which is next to the wall at King Henry's Road. And then I did the wall on King Henry's Road. And I started an organisation called the Fine Heart Squad, which was composed of artists and all kinds of different people to work with me. Well, we went very well with the King Henry's Road, and then we ran out of money. And so to finish the job, I got £100 from Camden and a phone call from someone called Berger, who said, would you like to work with these street artists from Chile who were in exile and living in squats in Prince of Wales Crescent, I think it was, in Kentish Town. And so we worked together. In Chile, street art was officially recognised as a popular art form and a way of people communicating. So if there was an issue somewhere, they would paint a mural about it, and then people would begin to discussion about the subject which was painted, you see. Street art was always used as a form of animation in the community. And that's what I believed too at the time. I believed it was a good way of triggering off people's ideas rather than just leaving it to the newspapers or the telly or whatever, you see. So you'd have something much more vibrant going on. It was a funny type of time. You see, there was a lot of IRA trouble and there was a lot of industrial trouble and there was, you know, problem. Everything was conflict, it seemed. So I had this idea of doing something which had a message of hope, really.
Are you amazed that your work is still up there all these years later?
I always thought that it should be like Speaker's Corner, you know, where you always have different things coming on and different things being produced, different speeches, different forms of expression, you know, like in Speaker's Corner. Except it takes a lot of energy to do street art. It takes a lot of energy, physical and spiritual.
That was the part that was that related to Chile. That was painted by the Chilean refugees.
I'm with Bea Thompson now, who's a local resident and who discovered that the wall was being painted. How did you discover that the section painted by the Chilean refugees was being painted over?
Well, I just came out of my house. There were two women there with white paint, and they had practically obliterated the whole wall without, as far as I knew, any consultation with anybody that lived in the vicinity. Certainly I didn't know about it, and I live opposite this painted wall and have done for 28 years.
Bea, what was underneath that white paint that we now see? Underneath there was the mural by the Chilean refugees. What did it actually look like before now? We can't see anything at all.
Well, it was really faded and difficult to discern, but it had Chile written on it in big letters and Solidarity, and then I think in one corner it had Chile Solidarity Campaign and some images. And it's true, it was faded and very shabby, but I still think it was an important piece of urban art. I would like, personally, David Burkitt came up with this idea, which I think is terrific. Whenever a mural is reinstated on that wall, whether it could perhaps depict the Chilean miners and that amazing feat of engineering, because, you know, having gone from having their democratically elected government overthrown, funded by the CIA, all those people imprisoned and tortured and lost for years, now suddenly Chile is in the news again for a completely different reason.
Local environment and climate change campaign Transition Primrose Hill whitewashed the wall in preparation for a new mural to be painted by local schoolchildren and the local community celebrating the flora and fauna of Primrose Hill. Planning group member Anna Locke told me they had tried to consult local people.
Had we had more time, we would have gone through much more consultation. We did have stuff out at Primrose Hill Fair with you know, the mural project and asking people to sign up for it and any contributors and help and ideas. You know, I mean, the basic thing.
And we did put a notice on the wall.
We did. We put notices on the walls and we, you know, and we alerted people. You know, with hindsight, we were coming into some difficulties anyway because the condition of the wall was really bad. So there's lead paint. So, you know, it was already kind of unfolding like it was going to be harder than we expected.
Did you realise that the wall had sort of significance before you sort of whitewashed the Chilean bit?
You know, as far as we were concerned, it had been there for a very long time. It was looking very, very faded. Network Rail didn't tell us, oh, but that was done by Chilean refugees. If they had, you know, it wouldn't have even got as far as it got. So the answer is no, we didn't know the significance. But I think that, you know, we're quite proud that as soon as we realised the significance, we then took action and held meetings. And we've now got to know these people and we've met Philip Hartigan. So I think we've turned it round.
Transition Primrose Hill are still hoping to go ahead with their project once the wall has been pointed and the lead paint removed. Anna told me of their plans.
I mean, we feel that there's potential to use that site so that, you know, we can celebrate biodiversity in our community. It doesn't have to be about what's on Primrose Hill, but because it's such a lovely preamble up to the hill, and many local people go up the hill that way, And also it would attract tourists. You know, I'd love to go to another country and go see a massive mural saying what flora and fauna was there.
This is Camden Unlocked for Radio 1812, International Migrants Day. Camden Community Radio's Harriet Bird was at the Somerstown Festival earlier this year.
The Somerstown Art Festival of Cultures, or START Festival of Cultures, is held every year on the second Saturday of July, on the site of the market in Chalton Street in Somerstown. It is the biggest street festival in Camden and attracts an average of 10,000 people throughout the day. The festival brings together people from all walks of life as it celebrates the diverse cultural communities of the area. This year, the festival took place on the 10th of July and was bigger than ever, coinciding with the British Library's celebration of 200 years of independence in South America. The inspiration behind a carnival procession of schoolchildren with drums, whistles and sparkling costumes. Lining the streets were stalls held by many of the organisations, big and small, that work hard to make Camden a great place to live. The weather was blissful and the melodious buzz of vuvuzelas filled the air when Camden Community Radio headed down to speak to some of them. And it was a busy day, so we do apologise for the sound quality of some of these recordings.
Today I'm bringing a bit of World Cup spirit to Charlton Street. All the way from South Africa, we're bringing the vuvuzela horn. You said what? It's the World Cup!
And where did you get hold of them?
They're all the way from South Africa, genuine. Oh, genuine from Johannesburg.
And who went there?
Well, actually, we've got a little connection. Yeah. So we got them flown out all the way, especially for the World Cup final tomorrow.
Fantastic. Are you doing a good business here?
We're doing excellent business. The day has just started for us and we've already sold about 20. We're doing great.
Have you been here before?
I have indeed. I have been here many times before. And every year, year on year, it just gets bigger and better and more impressive. And it brings the community together. It's such a great opportunity. All the young people involved, they're getting involved with some people from St. Mary's and Pancras, old students there. And we've got lots of fantastic, wonderful smells of all the cultural food. It's such a great opportunity to be here.
Fantastic. What's your favourite food?
My favourite food, I have to say, a big up to Josie over there, bringing a Dominican spirit all the way. Go, Dominica!
You wouldn't be connected with the Caribbean, would you?
No, not at all. Of course I am. All the way from Dominica myself. So I'm going to have to big up the aqua and the saltfish dumpling and the patty and the rice and peas and the curry goat. Yummy, yummy. You know what? I'm actually going to start wandering over there any minute now. But I better sell some more vuvuzelas first.
That was Marion Larrigue talking to Naomi, the vuvuzela saleswoman extraordinaire. And next, I spoke to Mohammed Chowdhury from Camden Council's My Project.
My name is Mohammed Chowdhury. I'm the Youth Participation Coordinator for Camden Council's Integrated Youth Support Services. We're promoting the My Project, which is Muslim Youth Project, part of our participation strategy here in Camden, to engage with primarily Muslim young people and other young people in looking at issues of identity and integration in modern contemporary British society.
Oh wow, so what does that involve? Come on,
that involves looking at the contribution that various parts of the community make to the whole of British society as we know it. So looking at, for instance, you know, how the African culture has made a contribution to what we consider British now. Like curry houses, you know, they've made curry has become more popular than most other sort of traditional sort of British food items, and just really recognizing the diversity and the positive contribution that everyone has made and how everyone could be sort of really quite proud of how we've managed to share our cultures across the board.
And where do you do this and when?
I'm based at the Crowndale Centre, which is where the Integrated Youth Support Services based. But with my project, we work with about 10 different separate groups of young people across the borough, going as far as Kilburn, Holborn, Kentish Town, King's Cross. The idea is to do a series of workshops, trips, seminars with young people to get them to talk about how they feel about diversity, identity, integration, how they feel they could share each other's cultures.
And they've made this magazine.
The second issue. We're really glad to say that we've just launched our second issue last week, and 90% of it is written by young people. This one particular one is about tracing the historical Muslim footprint across Britain, mainly Britain and Europe. So for instance, we went and met Prince Charles in Oxford University. We went to the British Museum and saw some pieces of ancient Islamic relics in the British Museum, like this of this coin, which was minted by King Offa of Mercia, Middle England, 1250 years ago. And it's got the inscription of the Muslim Testimony of Faith on it.
Okay.
So that's quite interesting, which most people didn't know about. We visited the Muslim Veterans Cemetery, all the Muslim soldiers that died during the First World War for this country. We've been involved with the Muju crew.
Okay.
That's Muslim Jewish theatre company, and they do comedy around stereotypes around Muslims and Jews. So we've been involved in a variety of things. We visited Kew Gardens, where there's an exhibition of gardens inspired by the Quran. Again, that was opened by Prince Charles as well. We've been involved with the police, talking about police stop and search, preventing violence, violent extremism, and how young people see the police efforts in the community, and how we could perhaps build better relations between the police and the young people.
Brilliant. Well, that sounds all fantastic. And are you a Camden, you know, born and bred?
I wasn't born here. I moved to Camden when I was about 5. So I've lived in Camden pretty much all my life, apart from my travels when I've gone abroad. But, you know, I went away to uni for a few years, but, you know, I'm about as much a Camden resident as you can get.
Brilliant. Well, I hope you have a good time today.
It's been brilliant so far. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. But it wasn't just organisations who were there on the day. There were individuals as well. Local people who live in Somerstown and wanted to show their appreciation of the neighbourhood. People were selling delicious homemade food all throughout the day. And other homemade things as well. So introduce yourself and tell me what you're doing here today.
Okay, my name's Anthony and we're down here, we're selling some soaps. They're all kind of inspired by where we've travelled, kind of in the Southern Hemisphere really. So we've got some things from India with neem oil, very kind of antiseptic, very good for if you've got dermatological properties. Used to be used for treatments of everything through to just from acne to really major clinical problems, through to some kind of Japanese-inspired ones. We've got other things. And then we actually, just to broaden it out, we also did some South Seas-flavoured food. So we've got some Indian rice called jada, which has almonds and raisins, very sweet. And some little South American empanaditas with a bit of black bean salsa going on. So just a little bit of a mix.
You're hoping people don't get confused and start eating the soap?
Well, there's one with honey in it. that might not be so bad, but the frothing at the mouth is going to be a problem, I think, for people.
I smell them. I think they look beautiful. Mm,
so that one's got this one's got calendula flowers through it and sunflowers. That's actually quite a subtle one, but we've got everything from to like a Caribbean bay rum with cinnamon, and that's got cinnamon leaves on it as well.
Yeah, you can really smell that. Amazing. And do you sell soap normally? Is that your...
It's a bit of a hobby.
It's a hobby. It's not
so,
a day job.
No, so I'm local though. I live in Somerstown.
Yeah.
So it's actually... I'm always here. I've lived here for about 10 years, so always come to the festival. So I thought this year, actually, maybe we'd make something.
And you've had an amazing
day out.
And there were lots of organisations which I had no idea even existed, such as this.
I'm Erica Malcolmson, and I work as a volunteer for CADFA. CADFA stands for Camden Abu Dees Friendship Association. We are a local charity promoting awareness of the human rights situation in Abu Dees, which is a small town in the suburbs of Jerusalem. It's now separated from Jerusalem by the wall. We organise trips between Camden and Abu Dees every year. 8 teenagers visited Camden from Abu Dees a few weeks ago. We have women from Camden travelling to Abu Dees, and we've had women in April this year travelling to Camden.
Like CADFA, lots of the people I spoke to worked for organisations whose influence went far beyond the boundaries of the borough. Like Attitude is Everything.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Ball, and I'm with Jenny as well, and we run an organisation called Attitude is Everything, and what it basically does is improve deaf and disabled people's access to live music.
Okay, and what does that involve?
Basically, we run a charter of best practice that music venues and festivals sign up to, and when they sign up to it, then they get help with how to improve their access and how we do training for staff as well about how to improve their attitude and their customer service. But it's not just about audiences, it's also about artists as well. So we try and improve the access for deaf and disabled artists too. We also run something called Glum Attitude, which is where we put deaf and disabled people in our club night, which is like a showcase for their work, and that happens 3 times a year. And our last showcase was at Glastonbury with a an organisation called Continental Dreams.
Amazing.
And we had half a day on the stage in the Shangri-La area, and it went really well.
Fantastic. And what are you doing here in Camden? Why are you at this Summer's Town Street Party?
Well, we've actually got offices here, so I'm just sitting outside the office. And I've been coming to the festival for a long time anyway, because I've worked on Chowton Street for, God, I think over 15 years, something like that anyway. So
you've seen the changes that Summer Town's been going through?
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
And what's your impression of the area? Do you think it's improving? Do you think it's changed? What's happened?
I think it is, but I hope that it's not just changing for sort of the people who sort of gravitate towards here and just work. What I want it to change for is for the community. So I think that's really, really important. I'm really glad that they've opened up the New Horizons building. That looks like a great place for everybody to go and sort of young people to get involved in. But I'm hoping that there's more things like that, because I am a little bit worried about what happens to communities, the local grassroots community, when it's always been here.
And Suzanne was not the only one who expressed worries about grassroots communities and development in the area. There were representatives from the UK Centre of Medical Research and Innovation talking to people about what the building's going to bring to the area. And just a few doors down from them was the stall for people who were against the development, people who felt that it was inappropriate for the area and wrong. As well as the UK CMR building, the King's Cross development was attracting attention. And I spoke to the representatives from Argent, the developers of the site.
I'm Anne Strongman. I'm a development manager for Argent, who are working on behalf of King's Cross Centre.
And what are you showing the people at the Summer Town Community Fair today?
So we work for the developers. We think it's important to tell people what's going on in their local area. So we're here with some maps and some information booklets. We're just talking to anyone who's interested, and hopefully as it develops they'll know what they're seeing over the road.
Yeah. And give me a brief outline then, what are we going to be seeing?
So it's a massive scheme, 8 million square foot, mixed use, so it'll be offices, houses, shops, community infrastructure like a new school, new swimming pool, new sports hall, cultural and leisure facilities, so a really wide range of uses on the development. We're in early stages, so at the moment we're working on a hotel, university, social housing, student housing, and lots of the roads and utilities and new public spaces.
Mm-hmm. And how is the reaction to the community so far from the development? What's your relationship like with them?
I think people generally seem interested in what's going on. They want to know when it's going to be done by. That's always a challenge for us because it's a long-term project. But in general, people seem interested and keen to know more, really.
Yeah. And what do you make of the kind of criticisms of the development that say that because it's got a lot of office blocks, it's got a lot of kind of places where people won't be living, it's people coming into the area to work, and it will disrupt the kind of feel of a community and the sense that people are living and have a kind of ownership of the area they live in. What's kind of your response to those criticisms?
Well, I think it's, I think the first thing to say, there isn't a community there at the moment. I mean, it's an open, vacant land, and nobody's ever lived there, really. So it's not like we're disrupting a community which exists, because there isn't one that's there. But I think it's fair enough for local people to think, God, there's a lot of things happening, and what does that mean for me? So if you look at what will happen, there are lots of offices, but that actually brings job opportunities.
Yeah.
And there are also houses within the development, and we've really tried to create a mix of different houses. So it's not just market housing, it's not just social housing, it's actually a whole range of different types of housing. And the other thing about the development is actually there'll be a lot of local facilities which are built within it, and cultural and leisure facilities, and new shops, and new bars, and new restaurants, which will again be a range. So they will be accessible if people want to use them.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned there about the development. Are local people being used in the construction process, or who's involved in the actual building?
Yeah, we've got four main contractors, and we work with our main contractors to develop local training opportunities. So we've built a training centre up on York Way, and that trains 120 apprentices. It actually takes 2 years for them to get their training, but we train 120 apprentices over that two-year period, and a number of those go through placements on the side. Bloody difficult at the moment, the contractors are up against it, but actually there's quite a lot of training going on.
Okay, well, thanks very much, and I hope you enjoy your day.
Yeah, thank you, and you too.
And that was Harriet Bird at the Somerstown Festival. 109 radio stations broadcasting in 37 countries. This is Camden Unlocked for Radio 1812, International Migrants Day all over the world. This is Camden Unlocked for Radio 1812, International Migrants Day all over the world. Radio stations broadcasting in 37 countries. And it's goodbye from us at Camden Community Radio, ccradio.org.